You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's program:
no politician in history has been treated worse or more unfairly. You can't let them get you down. You can't let the critics and the naysayers get in the way of your dreams.
The actual president of the United States tells newly commissioned officers in his nation's armed forces how tough life is for him. But is Trump on the verge of having something to cry about? My guests Brian Klass and James Rogers will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
Only 84% of the media report of the Labour Party in the last year has been hostile. So they could up their game and put it up to 90%. They could be fairer.
Does the leader of the UK's main opposition party have a point when he says that the country's media are out to get him? And even if he does, is it smart campaigning to go on about it? We'll also be asking whether Emmanuel Macron's unlikely ascent to France's presidency might inspire youth and independence in politics elsewhere. And as another Confederate statue is consigned to the dustbin of history, we will ask about the practical and political logistics of imposing the values of the present on the past. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to the show. My guests today are Brian Klass, fellow in comparative politics at the LSE, also author of The Despot's Accomplice, available now, and James Rogers, head of international journalism studies at City University here in London. Welcome both. And we will start, as we so often seem to, with US President Donald Trump, who has had quite an eventful week of it, even by his standards. With all due recognition that it's still only lunchtime in Washington and more or less anything could occur in the rest of today, here is where we appear to be. Plausible report. Reports have it that the president, in between supplying code word classified intel directly to Russia's foreign minister, asked the director of the FBI to abandon an investigation into his national security advisor shortly before sacking the head Fed, sending his surrogates out to deny everything and then confirming everything. Contributing to the general gaiety, Russian President Vladimir Putin has now helpfully offered to furnish a record of the Oval Office meeting between Trump and Sergei Lavrov, which would explain why the table lamps revolved whenever someone spoke. Brian, first of all, we heard a little excerpt at the top of the show there from Trump's bizarre, rambling, self-pitying speech to the US Coast Guard's new ensigns a little earlier. What did you make of the spectacle and sound of a spoiled billionaire whinging to young people volunteering to accept mortal danger in the service of their country?
Well, the one thing that is universally reflected in Trump's actions is narcissism. I mean, it's one of the few things, along potentially with protectionist nationalism, that has been consistent since the 1980s about Trump. I mean, genuinely, this is one of the core aspects of his personality. But this story, I mean, you know, he can make it about himself, the victim, etc. But, you know, that's playing politics. It's trying to make himself, seem like the underdog. Prosecutors don't care about whether you're an underdog. They don't care about the politics of this. And increasingly, we are beginning to move into a new phase where the political agenda is secondary to a question about whether criminal allegations are warranted. And that overnight is what has shifted. And that is why we have people like Senator John McCain, who's not exactly a man who's fit for hyperbole, saying that this is of the size and scope of the Watergate scandal, just 4 months into the Trump presidency. It's an astonishing turn in U.S. politics, and one that we're going to be talking about for decades.
James, is there any way at all you can see that all of this is somehow not quite as mad as it looks?
I don't think so, no. I mean, it is astonishing, really. And one thinks back to a lot of the speculation which went on in the autumn about, and now we know a lot more indeed since the autumn, about how Russia did or didn't interfere in the election campaign and the idea that Russia wanted Mr. Trump to become president. And one week it seems they probably did, and one week it seems they probably didn't. So it's very... difficult to see, I mean, anything more bizarre than this, really. And it's also very difficult to see where this goes. I mean, one wonders if there's been so much scandal so early on, whether indeed Mr. Trump can last of his full term. many listeners may know that in this country we're very keen on betting on politics, and I understand that those who are inclined to gamble on it, it's very difficult to get decent odds on Mr. Trump lasting 4 years.
I've said before, I'm sure, behind this microphone, that I either have or should give up trying to predict things where Donald Trump is concerned, because I sat here many times and airily predicted that there is no way that the grand old party would nominate him for president, and even less way that the people of the United States would elect him president, but both of those things quite clearly happened. But Brian, what do you think, as you watch this whole thing unfold, the thing that occurs to me, and I'm interested to know what you think, is that the entire system of the United States, those much vaunted checks and balances, none of them appear to have been designed to accommodate the possibility that the people of the United States might, in their wisdom, elect to the presidency a genuine simpleton who has absolutely no idea how anything works or what he's doing.
Well, I think the checks and balances were well designed. I think that they didn't take into account even more than that was polarization. I don't think that they anticipated that these men would be, and women in Congress would be, driving their agenda so clearly based on partisan stances. And this vortex of polarization has really intensified in the U.S. in the last few years. I mean, we have a situation now where people are making decisions about the integrity of democracy on polling, on partisan calculations. And even 5 or 10 years ago, that was much less true. It still was true. I mean, certainly politicians are self-interested individuals. They have been for a very long time. But you had much more cross-party voting. You had much more willingness to stand up to your own party. You had much more statesmen and stateswomen who were willing to sort of buck the party trend and do what was necessary rather than what was politically popular. And I think that has really shifted because of the media environment, because of the stark polarization, and because of just how divided the country is. And this is something that we're going to have to start thinking about, is if Trump does get either impeached or ends up resigning, it could really tear the country apart in a way that we have not seen before, because 30% of the country is diehard Trump supporters. And that is something where they are not simply going to roll over and say, okay, he's not president anymore, and we're okay with that.
James, are you surprised that we're not seeing more senior Republicans taking the country before party route? Or is it possible that some of those grown-ups who have been sent out to try and explain Trump or apologize for him, and a lot of these are serious people with serious reputations, people like Mattis, McMaster, mm-hmm. Tillerson, is it possible that they're thinking, we just have to suck this up, because if we weren't here, then who knows what would be happening?
Well, I think they certainly are at this stage. I mean, it is very early days still, if we think about this in terms of the entire presidential term. One thought that's kept coming back to me over the last few weeks is this. There was much made during the election campaign of the fact that Mr. Trump, were he elected, was going to be the first president who had not held political office or high military post previously. And I think in some ways we're seeing that lack of experience coming through. We're seeing Mr. Trump, the businessman, to some extent. If these remarks were indeed made in the Oval Office, it sounds a little bit like the sort of boast one might make to try to impress somebody. You know, I know this stuff and I can tell you this. It's the sort of thing he might have got used to in doing, you know, a property deal, a real estate deal or something like that. It really has no place in the higher echelons of diplomacy.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Brian, before we move on. The Senate Intelligence Committee has asked the dismissed FBI Director James Comey to testify. They also want him to hand over his memos. Now, if he does this, and if those memos are as damning as I think we can reasonably assume them to be, what does happen next?
Well, it depends what's in them, but I think that this is going down a really dangerous spiral for the Trump administration. Subpoenas being issued is a very bad thing for any political operation, but that's where we're headed. We're headed towards financial records. We're heading towards the possibility of tax returns. The memos themselves, by the way, could end up in a he said debate between Comey and Trump. And that's when the White House is going to be really regretful about the fact that they torpedoed their own credibility with things like alternative facts and inauguration photos. You know, they ended up destroying their own ability to control this story, because nobody is going to believe Donald Trump over James Comey after the last 120 days. And so I think that that's what we're heading towards, is these memos, these meticulous, detailed memos that James Comey has taken saying, I think something inappropriate happened and I wanted to document it. And he shared them with colleagues contemporaneously with the actual conversations, which means that it's not just going to be him. It's also going to be senior officials at the FBI corroborating that this was what Comey said after he met with Trump. So, you know, and back then he had no agenda really that was, you know, thought that he was going to get fired or anything. So I think we're going down a path where this is not going to go away and much more is going to come out. Even just today, there's another story about a Russian state bank financing a project that was involved with Trump Tower. And this is, you know, less than 12 hours since the Flynn story has broken. So broken wide open. So I think it's just going to continually spiral out of control. And it's going to get much worse for Trump before it gets any better.
Well, let's look now at the UK, which is currently spending what passes for summer here, undertaking its fourth divisive and rancorous electoral contest in as many years. In common with the 2014 Scottish independence referendum, the 2015 general election, and the 2016 EU membership referendum, the 2017 general election has provided yet another opportunity for supporters of every cause and or party to further consolidate their conviction that Britain's media is actively conspiring against them. James, first of all, does any contender, any participant in the current election have any reasonable right to complain that they're being unfairly done by?
Possibly. I mean, one thing about our newspapers in this country is that they are fairly sort of rude and insulting, and that's in some ways what they do best. You know, they're not polite and deferential in many ways. They are, that said, predominantly right-wing. So I think in
that sense, isn't that just reflecting the fact that so is the country?
No, it's not actually, because if you look back to the 1950s, there's one famous election in journalism studies from the early 1950s, which was about half, 97% of the votes were cast either for Labour or Conservative. And at that time, the press was roughly lined up with the way that people voted. And that is no longer the case. If you think particularly since the demise of the Independent as a printed title, the national newspapers in Britain are overwhelmingly right wing. And so I think, and that's this presumably the basis of the Labour Party in particular is complaining that they don't get a fair press. But then I think this is something which most politicians do in most democracies, in most places where the press are free to criticise. But I think it is true to say that, particularly if we look at the way the titles here lined up around the EU referendum, they did not, in their editorial lines, reflect the way that the vote actually fell in the end.
Brian, even if you do have a legitimate case as somebody running for office, and even if you do think that an unfair proportion of the nation's print and broadcasting and online outlets are not sympathetic, do you get anywhere by complaining about it, or does it make you just sound somewhat peevish? I think, and with all due acknowledgement that you can get yourself into a weird area quite quickly quoting Enoch Powell, but I think it was him who said that it's a politician has to regard the media like a sailor regards the weather. It's just there to be dealt with. There's no point complaining.
Yeah, I think when you're trying to make the story about your mistreatment by the media, it's a sign that you're losing.
Yeah.
I think that it's counterproductive. I think that the you know, as an American living in London, you have an inversion of the American media here in Britain. So you have in America, the print media tends to be more centrist, sober, responsible. That's what the airwaves media tends to be here, and it's exactly the inverse, right? So there's more,
yeah.
And I think that there's, you know, it's very much in the eye of the beholder. I have been in print media as a story of the BBC's bias in favor of the left, right? And I also was on a Sky News and saw two tweets literally within 20 seconds of each other, one claiming that the Sky News debate that I was participating in was totally biased in favor of Trump, and one saying it was totally biased in favor of Clinton. This was back during the election. So I think, you know, when Corbyn is talking about this, it's something where it's bad campaign politics, but it's also simply one of these things where, you know, trying to chase this impossible objectivity in journalism is something you cannot do. If you report a story that says Jeremy Corbyn is going to lose the election, that's technically negative towards him. This also seems to be true, right? Yeah. So there's a difference between bias and objectivity. And I think journalists want to have objectivity as much as possible. But if somebody is losing, if somebody is constantly making mistakes or running over people's feet, they can't write a positive story about that. Mm-hmm. It's just something where I think, you know, that's a reflection of the campaign itself and not something to cry over.
James, but this is the rage at this kind of thing, like most forms of rage, has been massively amplified by social media, hasn't it? And the confirmation bias that can lead people into. Because it strikes me that what I have never heard and never read, certainly on social media, is somebody complaining that the media is biased overwhelmingly in favour of their side.
No, and that's not what social media is for, really, is it? But I mean, I think there is one interesting thing. I mean, and we'll see what the election result is. And of course, we're all very circumspect about polls these days after the major upsets which they've delivered in the last few years. But it is consistently true to say of the polls that we've seen in this country in the last few weeks that the Conservatives have a substantial lead, and also though that many of the Labour Party's current policies enjoy a far greater degree of popularity than does the Labour Party's leader himself. That does, I mean, as far, if one's going to use polls as a basis for a starting point for journalism, then it does seem to be reasonable to at least ask whether Mr. Corbyn and his leadership team are perhaps the problem more than their policies.
I mean, Brian, we have during this campaign, as we see during every campaign, the media seizing delightfully on what is known in the trade as gaffes or occasionally clangers. We've seen a few politicians part company with the facts at various points. Diane Abbott, Len McCluskey, Philip Hammond. Those things, do we get the sense they really make any impact on voters? Is anybody going to change their mind as a consequence? I always just think that too much gets made of these things, largely on the basis that if somebody spends all day and every day having microphones stuck in their faces, they're going to say something daft at some point. And I mean, people just make mistakes, don't they?
Yes, they do, but I don't know if people are as forgiving as we would like them to be. You know, it depends, because there's some politicians who seem to be immune to, you know, gaffe after gaffe and have it not really sink them. But at the same time, I worked in campaign politics before I became an academic. I worked on I co-managed a political campaign for governor in my home state. And a lot of people voted based on who they liked. I mean, I think when you think about Ed Miliband, I think a lot of people voted against him because of the bacon sandwich photo. I mean, I think it was a real thing that he's this awkward sort of guy who doesn't have the Obama-esque character or the Cameron-esque character.
But again, this is what I mean. If you took enough photos of Barack Obama eating lunch, you would come up with a photo in which he looked weird and awkward.
Yes, and this is true, but I'm just saying that I think that this does move votes. I think that one of the things that Corbyn is contending with, which is much greater than media bias, is this idea that he is not this sort of strong leader, right? And this is one of the polling questions that I think predicts vote choice very, very strongly, particularly in perilous times that we live in, is who is better to lead the country in a crisis? Corbyn is, depending on the poll, in single digits on that one. I mean, you know, a lot of people like his policies when it comes to the NHS or education. But when that question is so badly distorted between Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, it makes it very, very difficult for him to win, because the country is thinking about who they want in charge across all possible scenarios, not just who is going to be the best on this particular policy. And a lot of voters don't vote on policy. I mean, that's one of the realities. A lot of voters vote on personality. So, you know, this is something where you can, you know, look at every manifesto in a very detailed manner, but a lot of people go with their gut.
James, that being the case, and if you are somebody like Jeremy Corbyn who is trailing badly on that front, and he is, the polling, as Brian says, is fairly unmistakable, is there anything he can actually do about it? I think we can probably agree that taking a somewhat peevish tone with the media and complaining that he's not getting it's not going to summon up any race memories of Churchill in anybody. No. Is there anything he can do?
No, I don't think there is. I mean, and I certainly, I think he's ill-advised to pursue this line, and as are indeed are his supporters. They obviously strongly feel it. They air these feelings frequently on social media, but, you know, they're not, in the end, in order to win an election, they don't just have to talk to each other, because they can shore up their own constituencies as much as they like. They have to convince large swathes of the wider voting public that they're the right people to do it, and they have to do that through the media, like it or not, conventional media or social media.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Brian Klass and James Rogers. Coming up, are other countries going to start looking for their own Emmanuel Macrons? And should we really be tearing down controversial statues? Do stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Brian Klass and James Rogers. Now, the recent election of Emmanuel Macron to the presidency of France suggested that a couple of hitherto impenetrable barriers to high office might have been removed, or at least lowered. Macron won without the backing of any established political party and despite his youth. At 39, Macron is the youngest French head of state since Napoleon. Austria's Conservative People's Party, the junior partner in Austria's coalition government, hopes that this acceptance of younger leaders may be catching. They've just appointed the country's foreign minister, 30-year-old Sebastian Kurz, as its new head. James, we're going to see a lot of this. People trying to be the new Emmanuel Macron. Is he going to be one of those transformative politicians?
Possibly. I mean, I think people are quite keen to be the new anything if they can. And if we look at polls everywhere, and it's not just in the Western world where we've seen them sort of thrown into sharp contrast with the unexpected results we've had in various elections here in the last few years, but right across the world. I was reading a poll about the Palestinian territories recently, and people were asked who their favourite leader was, and the largest single category, 40%, was none of the above. So I think there's a sort of general disaffection, and I wouldn't be surprised if politicians seeing, for example, the unexpected, as it would have been 12 months ago, success of Monsieur Macron, are willing to try too, and so it may well be what Mr. Kurz is thinking.
Brian, I think I'm right in saying that your country's constitution sets the bar at 35 for a head of state. Is there such a thing as too young to lead?
Yeah, I think there is. And I say this as somebody who's in his 30s himself. So, you know, but I think that there is something where you have to have a significant amount of experience. You have to understand the political landscape. You have to have experience building coalitions. And I think that that is something that is not impossible to attain at a young age, but it's still something where there is value in sort of setting the bar that we have stepping stones, right? And I think that people being tested in politics is important. But I think that this story is also beyond the age factor, symptomatic of the fact that the power of parties is declining globally. Mm-hmm. And part of this is because we have cross-cutting policy ideas that don't simply line up with left or right anymore. You know, the rural-urban divide in the U.S. is probably the strongest predictor of vote choice now. How do you line up with globalization or the EU? That is not simply the same as left or right anymore. There are people who are crossing party lines for those issues and voting as the primary driver of the way that they determine how to vote. So, you know, with all of these people like Macron and Kurz in Austria, it's something where you have a weakening of the sort of elite-led party fabric. And I think that's going to intensify over time as you know, Donald Trump's opened the floodgates in the United States to that, Macron in France, and I think it's going to be increasingly the case across Western Europe.
James, would you personally cast a vote that would elect a 30-year-old prime minister?
Yeah, I would. I would if I thought that they had, you know, the makings of being a good prime minister. I don't think age need necessarily be a barrier. I mean, one thing I would say, and this isn't the case with Mr. Kurz, is I think particularly if we look at the recent history of this country, and if we look, for example, at the prime ministerships of Mr. Cameron and Mr. Blair, some of their critics and some of their observers would say that they came to be prime minister without having had ministerial experience, and that came to tell later in their careers. They didn't pick up what you learn as a minister, as a junior minister, and so on, and that's not the case with Mr. Kurz. So for me personally, no, it would not be an obstacle.
Okay, well, finally tonight, it's 2 years, give or take, since the City Council of New Orleans voted to dismantle four landmarks commemorating personages pertaining to the Confederate States of America. Two have now been removed. A third, a statue of General Pierre-Gustave Tuton de Beauregard, was dismantled in the early hours of this morning, leaving only Robert E. Lee still standing. By way of demonstration of the passions aroused, workers undertaking the removals have worn masks and bulletproof vests. Brian, this is always a strange judgment, I guess, because it's not just a question that comes up in the United States. It's the imposing of the standards of the present on the actions of the past to an extent. Do you think New Orleans should be taking these statues down?
This is a very tricky topic, and it's extremely racially sensitive and difficult, but I think that...
This is probably where we should acknowledge that we are three white guys discussing this.
Yes, well, this is true. But look, I think that there's a problem of going down this road that ends with everybody in the past being eliminated, because virtually everybody in the past, especially if you go back 150 years, held abhorrent views by our standards.
Well, you could start taking down statues of Washington and Jefferson because
everyone.
They owned slaves.
Exactly. Mm. And that's where I think, you know, what is a fairly reasonable middle ground here is to update the plaques to make clear that we are memorializing the past, but in a way that's not venerating it, particularly in the sense where people were genuinely, you know, evil and bad people. And the second aspect of this is to judge statues by the standards of their time to an extent, right? So statues of Hitler are obviously not supposed to be up anymore because he was awful by the 1940s standards, right? And that's one sort of middle ground way where you can think, okay, in the Confederacy, there were some really bad people. And yet, you know, Robert E. Lee was generally well-respected. He was generally somebody who, you know, people looked up to as a leader. He could have been in charge of the Union Army, but he decided to go for Virginia, his home state. Now, he owned slaves. And a lot of people throughout the United States did too, and that's abhorrent and you know, unspeakable. But it's also something where, can we just forget the past? Is it more damaging to just pretend it didn't happen? And I think part of this is that racial conversations can benefit from the fact that there are constant reminders of where we came from that can point to the fact that this is still a very real problem. If we just sanitize the past, then a lot of white people in the South might say, well, this isn't really a big deal, and Black Lives Matter and all that is just, you know, manufacturing a problem without acknowledging the very real racial divide that does exist in the United States.
The trouble is, I guess, James, that there isn't. It's not like there are one hard and fast set of rules you can apply to everything, is it? I mean, I can well understand, for example, why people in Baghdad wish to remove statues of Saddam Hussein. I can well understand why the people who'd been unwilling citizens of the Soviet Empire throughout the Cold War period wanted to tear down all the statues of Lenin and Stalin. It would seem strange to leave them up. But in this particular case, when they are commemorating events that happened a long time ago, should they stay or should they go? We have the similar arguments occasionally happen in Britain with the statues of Cecil Rhodes at various universities, even the one of Bomber Harris on the Strand.
I mean, I think I think it is quite important to remove these things sometimes, if only as a symbol of change. I mean, what I'm not necessarily in favour of is destroying them. I mean, talking about Russia, for example, I was a journalist in Moscow in the early post-Soviet period, the very late Soviet period, when a lot of these things were taken down in Moscow and indeed elsewhere. And what they decided to do there in some cases was they actually found a corner of Gorky Park, a very large park in the centre of the city, and put some of the statues there. And the last time I was there, which is some years ago now, you could still go and see them some 20 years after they've been removed. In other words, they hadn't been destroyed, but it was an opportunity for the people of the city to go and witness some of
their
history.
There's a similar installation in Budapest. There's a communist theme park there. I mean, is that a way forward, Brian? Because I can well understand that if you are a black citizen of New Orleans, I can understand that it would be difficult and unpleasant to walk past these statues every day as you go about your business. Is the argument for instead, I guess, to quarantine them in effect?
Yeah, and this is where there can be also a middle ground to have a statue replace, for example, a particularly vile Confederate general with a memorial to slavery, for example, right? Where it's still acknowledging the past without venerating some of the figures in it, and sort of changing what we remember from the past a little bit and highlighting the forgotten histories. That is one way you could do that, and you could put the Confederate statues in museums, right? I mean, that is one possible way forward. I think it's something that the locals have to decide themselves, and I don't think it's you know, In every situation, it's a bit different. There's, for example, in Memphis, there's a statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who by the Confederate standards was a really bad guy. I mean, he massacred prisoners, and then he founded the Ku Klux Klan right after, and there's still a statue of him, right? He is a much worse person to venerate than somebody like P.T. Beauregard in New Orleans, whose statue was just removed, or Robert E. Lee. So there's degrees of nuance here, and I think you have to sort of think about, if we're applying our standards to the past, can we have any statues intact? And if we can't, then that's a real problem, because I think history is important to remember.
Yeah. Just finally, then, I'll ask you once each, James, are there any statues that you would quite happily take a bulldozer to yourself?
No, but I was quite glad as an occasional goer to football matches at Fulham's ground in West London when they removed a rather odd statue of Michael Jackson, which had stood there, I think as a token, whatever one might think of the singer, I think in consequence of his friendship with the club's former owner.
Yes, it was. It was a deeply peculiar work of public art, that one. And you, Brian?
I think the one I mentioned, the Nathan Bedford Forrest one in Memphis, I mean, that's one where you just, we should be able to agree that the guy who founded the Ku Klux Klan shouldn't have a statue anymore.
You know? Brian Klass and James Rogers, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jimena Minan Vega. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 1900, you can hear Daniel Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs. I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.